A week is a long time in politics, but the 2 weeks since our last podcast has felt like an age.
Yes, now normally we don't discuss politics on this podcast, but Nadeem Sahawi's sacking over his tax arrangements has had a lot of lawyers involved, including, of course, friend of the show, former Clifford Chance tax head Dan Needle, who has been speaking to more broadcasters than you can shake a stick at.
Yes, and in his summary of the events, he named a number of journalists from the Financial Times and the Times and so on who were covering the story alongside his investigation. But he's also singled out the lawyer, and he called you Fearless Cat.
Yes, that was very nice of him, and I'll take that. Well, we certainly did cover his tussle with Osborne Clarke, who were advising Nadeem Sahawi, when he was calling out the firm over slaps, the strategic lawsuits against public participation. And at that time, it might have felt quite a niche point to cover, because even our audience doesn't hugely connect with these media issues at first sight. But it's absolutely fundamental when you consider the role that so-called confidential lawyers' letters play in the wider picture of intimidating the press to not report stories.
Yeah, and as much as Dan didn't, you know, set out to achieve Nadeem Sahawi being sacked, the story is certainly one for the history books, because it's not often that a Magic Circle partner or a former Magic Circle partner plays a key role in bringing down a Tory chairman.
Absolutely. Anyway, let's get on with this episode of The Lawyer Podcast. I'm Katrin Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Christian Smith, litigation editor at The Lawyer.
And this week we'll be joined by new Hot 100 member Banke Odonaike, who is head of legal EMEA and APAC at CBRE.
The Six Nations rugby starts this weekend as a cloud of legal issues and legal controversy hang over the game. We'll look into what those are and the future relationships between lawyers and rugby.
And we cross to Oslo to speak with our international editor, Alex Taylor. Not about Oslo, that will come in a future podcast, but about a potential partnership between Taylor Wessing and an Iberian firm that may have global ramifications.
But first, there was much excitement last October when merger negotiations began between Womble Bond Dickinson and BDB Pitmans, because it was the latest example of national combinations being tried out as firms attempt to find safety in weight. But as the lawyer revealed just yesterday, the merger is now off. Richard Simmons is the lawyer's deputy editor, national, and joins us now. Rich, you know both firms well. Take us through your immediate thoughts on the collapse of merger talks.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really interesting moment, a moment for both firms that feels like, well, kind of a turning point, but more so for BDB Pitmans than for Womble Bond Dickinson. You'll probably remember that these firms are both actually products of mergers themselves. So Womble Bond Dickinson was originally Dickinson Dees, big Newcastle stalwart and a sort of titan of the Northeast. And it joined up with Bond Pierce down in the Southwest, and then went transatlantic via another merger with Womble Carlyle. But it's still, you know, very much this sort of UK national beast.
Mm. But take us through to BDB Pitmans as well. So talk us through, if readers aren't particular, if listeners, I should say, are not particularly familiar with that firm.
Yeah, well, that was a strange merger as well, because it was Birch and Dyson Bell, London firm, Westminster firm. But it had not been performing particularly well pre-merger. It'd been overtaken by a lot of its London peers, and it was being outcompeted for its work by some larger firms like Pince and Masons, who could do the same thing but with economies of scale. And then you've got Pitmans out in Reading, which was this rather undistinctive regional outfit. So neither firms were doing particularly spectacularly, and they came together. But it was a merger that didn't really solve the underlying problems that either firm had. It didn't make Pitmans more distinctive, and it didn't give really Bertram's the scale to compete with its much larger rivals. So it was kind of, I suppose, a case of 2 + 2. It does equal 4, but the 4 things are, you know, a trombone, a road sign, a brick, and a leaf. You know, you've got more stuff than you had before, but it's still useless if you kind of want a 4-piece band. And that to me is where BDP Pittman's got to. It became this larger firm, but a firm actually without any real focus to it. And so it hasn't really performed very well since it merged back at the end of 2018.
No, that's right. I mean, the revenue figures are actually, they're not desperately impressive, aren't they? I mean, they were sort of around sort of 53 million and so on, which would have been about, would have made up about a third of the total had they merged with Robin Bond. So it would have been part of this greater whole. But actually, that's the past. That's kind of where we got to. What now? What now for either side, either the Womble Bond, by which we mean, by the way, the UK side of it, which is sort of 175 million it would have been in total. What now for Womble Bond and what now for BDB Pittman's? What are the options left?
Well, yeah, I said it was kind of a turning point, pivotal moment for both sides. I mean, Womble Bond Dickinson, actually, I think will just, sorry to do the pun, but keep wombling on. It's a large international firm now. It's not an astonishingly exciting firm, but it's, you know, it's big and it's out there doing its stuff in its markets. BDP Pittman's, I think it has a bigger conundrum to face. I think the management there is pretty clear-sighted that it needs to be a bigger firm than it is now if it wants to compete. I think it has a few options. The first option is probably pretty unlikely. It could radically streamline and boutiqueify itself, if you will. It's pretty difficult to do, but I suppose it could be done. The second option, perhaps it could look at what it's got, its practice now, and attempt to become a southeast outside London regional powerhouse. It feels like there is a bit of a gap in the market. There's a lot of firms sort of trying to fill that space, but not quite done it right. Or its third option, I feel like it's the most likely, is find another merger partner like Womble Bond Dickinson. But the question, I suppose, is who?
Thank you, Rich. Very interesting to see what's on the cards now for both those firms.
Now, here at The Lawyer, we released our annual Hot 100 list last week, naming 100 UK lawyers who are doing some of the most exciting work on the market.
And one of them was Banke Odinaika, who is head of legal for EMEA and APAC at CBRE, the Global Commercial Property Consultants. And I caught up with her earlier about her career, why property is exciting, and why being a role model doesn't faze her. Banke, welcome and congratulations on being in the Hot 100 and indeed our first in-house interviewee for the Lawyer podcast. Now, you've ended up with a big role in the commercial property world, but you've had a very interesting zigzag of a career in terms of specialism. So talk us through it.
Well, zigzag sounds a little chaotic. I'd say au contraire. It was more of a sort of protean career. And, you know, yes, I was very versatile and very open to different opportunities. And I started as a trainee at Goschutz in Hull. And when I qualified as a trainee solicitor, I was offered a role in commercial property. And the first thing that crossed my mind was, oh no, the deeds. Because as a trainee, we all dreaded going down into the vault and having to deal with these really archaic documents. You know, some of them were really beautiful and some of them you just thought you might catch the plague from. So, you know, that was the first thing that crossed my mind. And the reason that was, and I know it sounds really fickle, but it was because I had my mind elsewhere. I had done my seat in corporate and employment and I had exposure to pensions and I wanted to be a pensions lawyer. I wanted to pursue that line of career. Yes, some agents thought I was bonkers, but then I decided to turn down commercial property and actually go and pursue pensions. And so I carried on in the on that route, and I was offered a role at Shoesmiths and as an NQ. So obviously spent the first few months of training up and then practicing as a pensions lawyer, was with Shoesmiths and then went on to Addleshaws. I was headhunted by Addleshaws and joined them as a foundation member of their London team and was with them for about just under 5 years. And I quickly realized whilst I was in private practice that there are two types of pensions lawyers. There's the and they'll probably hate me for saying this, but there are the pensions lawyers who are really technical and they eat legislation for breakfast, Catherine. And so then you have the other sort of pensions lawyers who get really excited about pensions and your commercial aspects of pensions in transactions. And so I was that lawyer. I was the one who got excited about, you know, Section 75 debt when it came to an M&A deal. And so I quickly realized that I had a lot of interest in commercial and I wanted to pursue that. And so it was a matter of just staying open to what opportunities might be out there. And also keeping in mind that my goal ultimately was to end up in-house working closely with a business. And so Mercer came into the picture. I applied for the role. It was a great transition from private practice into Mercer because, you know, it was a good combination of what I was currently doing at the time. So actuarial consulting, investment management, health and benefits consulting services. So I transitioned into that and, you know, took a lot of my skills into that and I was there for 5 years and then started to think, well, what next? What's the next thing for me? Got this LinkedIn advert for the role at CBRE and here I am.
And absolutely, the rest is history. So and what's yes. really interesting about looking at what you're saying is that you were driven by what interested you. You weren't driven by titles or status. And does that mean, do you think you took risks? Is that important for younger lawyers to do that, do you think?
Absolutely. I think you've got to allow yourself to be really malleable and flexible and just step out of your comfort zone. Because for me, that's where I do my most of my learning is when you're outside of that comfort zone. So you've got to really allow for some flexibility. The law is so versatile, you know, and it's so, you know, it very much moves with societal demands. And so, you know, I mean, right now we have ESG lawyers, right? And so you've just got to allow for that flexibility. Just, you never know where it would take you, but always just, you know, have faith that it would take you in the right direction.
Absolutely. And there's a sort of an irony, isn't it? You know, you originally wanted to do pensions law. You didn't want to be sort of in property. And now look at you, you're actually sort of embedded in this
back in it.
Huge
yes.
global sector. Actually, and let's talk about that in your day job at CBRE. What do you think, for someone who isn't really sort of aware of the big issues facing the global property industry, what are the biggest issues facing that sector? And do you have any advice for anyone who wants to go into that sector?
Well, you know, speaking about issues, I mean, one of the things that we're all in the thick of this, you know, economic climate and the financial crisis. So inevitably that has an impact on, you know, capital markets activity, on brokerage and indeed the valuation of assets. So, you know, good and bad. And let's not forget that we're still recovering from the impact of the pandemic, right? So there's a lot that's going on. We've seen some areas in our business that have absolutely grown, you know, and boomed and continue to do so, you know, logistics, for instance, or operational real estate. And there are others that have just really slowed down. And that's not unique to us. Anyone who's looking to come in-house or come into the industry, I mean, we talked about sort of that flexibility, versatility of a mindset, but just having that growth mindset and that determination and focus and staying attuned to what's going on in the wider world. So that would be my pitch.
Interesting. And what do you think as a prominent Black woman, do you feel added pressure, you know, as a very visible role model within,
no.
Interesting. Okay, go ahead.
Would you like me to expand?
Yes.
Well, I don't, because I feel it is a duty. It's something that's innate in me. I feel that for those who need to see to be, I want to pay it forward. I want to be visible. I want for them to see that it is possible to be a woman, a Black woman from African origins who is able to hold this sort of post. But I must say, I don't subscribe to the notion that you cannot be what you cannot see, because if we all allowed for that psychological limitation, Kat, you know, we just simply, change will never have a point of inception. So I don't believe in it. But for those who do, I make myself visible.
Fantastic. Before I let you go, I think I'm going to have to force you to share what your son told you.
He's a joker, isn't he? So he said when I shared the news about making the Hot 100 list, he'd said to me, you know, one day, he said, "Oh, Mom, I'm feeling a bit cold. I'm just going to hug you a little longer because you're a hot lawyer."
Fantastic. That's that has to be an aspiration for any working parent. That's brilliant. Okay, it's been an absolute pleasure and thank you so much and congratulations again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
We cross now to our international editor, Alex Taylor, and his map room again, which he's actually relocated to the Norwegian capital of Oslo, where he is this week there for many meetings with all the movers and shakers of the Norwegian legal market. AT, I suppose, you know, the most important question, of course, is how's the weather?
Yeah, it's cold. It's really cold. To put a figure on it, we're currently at -4 degrees, which is not a temperature that I'm particularly accustomed to. Christian, I know it's not a temperature that you're particularly accustomed to.
Absolutely not.
So to say it's cold is an understatement. But, Christian, do you know where it's not cold?
Where is it not cold?
It's not particularly cold in Spain, where me and Christian have done our research in the name of quality journalism. In Madrid today, it's 14 degrees, and I want to talk about Spain.
And you have been looking at a potential strategic partnership that is in the offing between London-headquartered Taylor Wessing and Iberian firm Etihad. What's the backstory? Why would they want this partnership in the first place?
Flexibility, I guess, is probably the big word. I actually think there's something really interesting going on with firms looking for greater tech capabilities. So I've obviously spoken on this podcast and written at length about what happened in Warsaw with Rui Majadot and Maruta Wacta. There was a big opportunity there for them to get greater tech expertise, and they did it. Now, when you look at Taylor Wessing's geographic footprint, Spain is really the last kind of major Western economy in Europe that they didn't have there. Etihad have grown rapidly in recent years. I mean, they were founded in 1997. Last year, they did about 70 million euros. So I had a look at the UK 200 as a basis for comparison, puts them more or less in line with Blake Morgan. But they offer way more to Taylor Wessing than, I guess, a merger with Blake Morgan would, really. And it's the TMT link. It's completely what Etihad is all about. It was founded in 97 by Hugo Etihad, who actually has quite an interesting backstory. You know, he's the sort of son of a cab driver. Sort of real boy done good story. His brother Alvaro is also a cybersecurity lawyer as well. But I think Hugo, having brought this firm from 97 to today, has maybe found the perfect strategic alliance partner in this sense.
Yeah, and this partnership, I mean, for Taylor Wessing, it's not just about Spain, is it?
No, it's not. And it would be wrong to think about this as just Taylor Wessing making a strategic play into Spain. I mean, Etihad does have 6 offices in Spain. You know, it's in Madrid, it's in Barcelona, it's in smaller places like Las Palmas. But this is as much about Etihad's recent push into Latin America as it is about Iberia. I mean, I suppose one person who's, you know, clued in on the Iberian market far more than I, and I'd like to think that as a journalist, it's kind of our responsibility to speak to people who are far more informed about these markets than we are. And actually, they said something which you don't come across too often, which is that they said it could be a world-changing move if they do manage to pull this together. I mean, it would be a move of real significance for an Anglo-German firm to have found a Iberian partnership with such close ties to Latin America as Etihad actually does. To my mind, there's no one with the real size that has the kind of boots on the ground in the way that Etihad does. Usually when you look at the link between kind of Spain and Latin America, you get firms kind of like Uria Menendez, you get firms like Garriga, like Quatrecafez. But for Taylor Wessing to have a real close tie with a firm like that, I actually do think that's a move of real significance, and we'll find out which way it's gone by late February. But yeah, I think it's a pretty shrewd move if they can get it through.
Well, look, one last very important question. What would this move mean for Taylor Wessing staff? Are we about to see them seconded, sunning themselves on the beach in Tenerife, where Etihad have an office?
I think the point we need to remember here is that law firm branded pens are fine, law firm branded notepads are fine, but Taylor Wessing has a chance to do something here that law firms have never done, which is provide law firm branded sun cream bottles to its associates in preparation to ensure that they make the most of these potential secondments over to Spain, to Portugal, and to cities across Latin America. Again, a world-changing move from a progressive law firm.
Thank you very much, AT. You go and enjoy Oslo. I hope you find yourself some law firm branded gloves to keep you warm.
Cheers, mate. Much obliged.
Well, moving on, the Six Nations rugby begins this weekend, and it's fair to say that there will be plenty of lawyers up and down the land who are going to be very excited by this. Now, before everyone thinks that Christian's finally got his way and turned this into a rugby podcast, it's actually what is happening off the field with the lawyers that is grabbing our attention. Christian, you are indeed our unofficial rugby correspondent. Tell us about everything that is going on with all those lawsuits and everything like that. There's a lot of activity, isn't there?
Yeah, look, that's right. I can't really remember a time when so many legal issues have hung over the game of rugby, and in particular legal controversies as well. I mean, I'm going to race through some of the issues that are affecting rugby at the moment because there's quite a few. We could do the whole podcast on this, to be honest. But let's just start off with what's been happening this month. And most of these issues have come through in the last couple of months. Earlier in January, the RFU introduced a whole bunch of new tackle laws into the game to basically say that anything below professional level is going to be restricted to tackles at the waist height or below. That was insanely controversial, in part because there was no consultation done at all with the clubs and with the players. They've now backtracked on that massively and apologised, and there was actually a petition with more than 75,000 signatures asking them not to do that. The thing is, though, I mean, apart from the fact that that's probably been written by lawyers at some point, is also that it comes as a result, well, they won't admit this, but it's pretty inevitable that it has. It comes as a result of at least two so far concussion lawsuits that have been launched against the RFU, the Rugby Football Union, which is England's governing body, the Welsh Rugby Union and World Rugby. One was launched in January that was 55 amateur players who are basically suing the game, saying that they were negligent with regards to concussion as they played. There was also another case that was brought last year by more than 200 former professional players. Both of these cases have been brought by Rylands and the partner there, Richard Boardman, along with counsel from 39 Essex and Farrah's Building. And clearly, you know, the fact that this new law was introduced into rugby kind of dramatically and out of nowhere does make you think that they're a bit spooked at the RFU and elsewhere, that they have to react so quickly. So, I mean, that is incredibly interesting and it's going to continue affecting the game. There's also other issues involving the England captain, Owen Farrell, who was taken through a legal disciplinary process recently that was chaired by Philip Evans, KC of QEB Hollis Whiteman Chambers, and Richard Smith, KC of Guildhall. Chambers was his barrister. A lot of controversy there in the fact that he was essentially, many people think, let off for a high tackle, which obviously sits in massive irony given the fact that the RFU is now cracking down so much on tackling in other areas of the game. I think it's probably important to emphasise that that whole judicial process is independent. It's done by lawyers, and it's a pretty common thing across sports law for this sort of thing to happen. But the perception, which is obviously a huge thing when it comes to the law, is that it's not.
So, there's an awful lot of issues you touched on there that are to do with personal injury, essentially. I mean, but there's other massive policy issues and regulatory issues that are sort of besetting the game, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like interesting to see it's sort of the outside world affecting rugby in ways that perhaps rugby wouldn't have foreseen. So, for example, I think it was just this week, Scotland Rugby has now banned men identifying as women playing in the women's game. That is now in line with what the other home nations have already done. The Welsh Rugby Union as well is in chaos right now. Its CEO, Steve Phillips, resigned over the weekend. There have been many allegations following a BBC investigation, allegations of sexism and racism and homophobia at the governing body. Apparently, a large law firm, one of the largest in Wales, had already been in to investigate some of the allegations, and they had been unable to substantiate the claims involved there. But now there's also going to be a new independent panel set up to investigate the situation. Last year, Wasps and Worcester clubs, they're clubs in the Premiership Rugby, which is the top tier division of England rugby, both collapsed. Essentially, there's a lot behind that, and I'm not going to go into it now, but essentially, you know, COVID had a huge impact, but also other financial issues. And that will inevitably result, and there's a huge debate going on in rugby and amongst rugby lawyers now about what to do about this, but it will inevitably result in increased regulation of the game. That will then also inevitably mean more lawyers are involved. So the more you look at it, the more you see lawyers continuing to be involved in this game.
That's extraordinary. I mean, to be honest, you know, I am Welsh, but I didn't realise there was quite this number of issues. And it sounds like we should probably change ourselves into the rugbylawyer.com instead of thelawyer.com. But anyway, but why are lawyers so much more involved now than they have been in the past? This is a very recent phenomenon, right?
Yes and no. I mean, lawyers have obviously always been involved in rugby and other sports, of course. I mean, I was speaking to Bird and Bird's Max Duthie, who's a partner, a sports law partner there, a few months ago, and he himself used to be a professional rugby player, but he went on Lions tours for many years just to South Africa and New Zealand and Australia as their team lawyer. But it's clear, and this is a case across many sports, particularly interestingly as well, women's sports, which are obviously increasing in popularity, in large part it comes down to professionalisation and money, basically. So rugby went professional in the 90s. Before then it was an amateur game, you know, much longer than football ever has been, and that inevitably results in more competition around, you know, what happens in the game, because people want to make sure their money is being defended, and people are more willing to put money into legal aspects of the game. I mean, if you just look in the past few years, the private equity firm CVC Capital Partners invested in Premiership Rugby in 2018. They also invested in the Six Nations in 2021. I think, again, like I said before as well, there's also wider legal and social issues entering the game from the outside world, which, you know, you have things like concussion, which isn't something that, you know, anybody who watched rugby pre kind of the 2010s would see, that essentially, you know, people would get knocked out on the field and then get up and keep playing.
And it's interesting because obviously from a legal market perspective and who's involved, you talk about there have been lots of specialists who've been working in this area. But with the advent of money and CVC's investment and so on, you get magic circle firms who are coming in who are acting for private equity. So actually the sort of the type of lawyers who are involved in this work has changed.
Well, it's a very good point, because the thing is, sports law is an area of law that is kind of a little bit made up. So, you know, a lot of sports lawyers will tell you that there are sports lawyers, but a lot will tell you that there's no such thing as a sports lawyer. Essentially, a sports lawyer is someone who covers a huge number of areas of law, whether it might be employment, where it might be commercial litigation, it might be regulatory, whatever it might
brands.
Be.
Yeah.
Brands, yeah. IP, mm-hmm. Exactly. And what they do is act in the sports world. So rather than being a practice area specific lawyer like a construction lawyer, they are just people who act for sports teams or players or investors, and therefore have quite a wide knowledge of the market of the law, which, you know, in many ways makes it a really exciting job.
Yeah, it's a great place to be a generalist. I mean, it sounds like you're a specialist, but in fact you're a massive generalist. Well, this has been great. Thank you for that tour of everything that's been going on, Christian. But I mean, although obviously I am going to, in advance of this weekend, I'm going to have to teach you the words to my hen lad van Hadde, aren't
I? Well, I do have most of my ancestors who moved to New Zealand were Welsh, so I can get on board
with that.
That's
the best part of you. Well, that's all we have time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you very much for listening. You can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com. And of course, you can find more about anything we've been discussing at thelawyer.com.
We'll be back again in a fortnight. Until then,
goodbye.